The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Good morning. How are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement. And I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie, on the Radio Kerry app or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. Lots of you getting in touch with us about our monthly focus photography slot, wondering what the theme is. It's capturing the moment. Or capturing moments if you want, and you can send no more than 3 photos. You can email them to jmcgill@radiokerry.ie before midday Wednesday, before the first Saturday of the month. We have a very busy programme lined up for you. We'll have very shortly a very popular slot we do on this programme from time to time with Tom Lynch from Birdwatch Ireland, and of course a Dingle native, and everyone loves to get involved when Tom comes on the programme. And we're going to be talking about nesting birds and fledglings and or flying the nest that they're doing at the moment. And also, I wanted to talk to Tom last time about the sea birds that we have around our wonderful coast. Well, so I'll be talking to him about that very shortly. It is the second Saturday of the month, so later on we'll have our Kerry County Council Creative Kingdom letting you know what's going on in the arts world. And we'll be talking about Annam Tralee, that wonderful festival, and also the Con Curtin Music Festival, which takes place in Brosna. And Con Curtin would have been 100 years of age last year, and I think they're celebrating 21 years this year, so that's going to be very interesting as well. And if that wasn't enough, we'll be talking to members of Oral History Network Ireland as well, or as ONI as they're called. They have a very special 2-day event taking place in Tralee in the coming weeks, so we'll be talking to them about that, and also about how you can get involved if you want to capture oral history and how do you go about doing that. So we'll be talking to them very soon. But I mentioned we're going to be speaking about the birds this morning, and who better to have on than Tom Lynch. Tom, you're very welcome. How are you this morning?
I'm very good, very good. Good morning to everybody. Hope in good form with the improvement in the weather and the whole lot, so it should make for a good weekend.
Yeah, and tell us, last time we were talking to you, you were getting ready for the Dawn Chorus in Dingle. How did that go? That was the fail in a belt, no?
It was actually very good. About 50 people turned up, and in an hour and a half, and then on cue at 48 o'clock it rained, so we were all able to go home, and it was very enjoyable. It's on the grounds there of Tashdeelia, and it's probably the oldest bit of woodland on the peninsula, so we had lots of woodland birds, blackbirds, robins, lutes, great, it's all that kind of stuff. So and people got to see some of them, and we had a few whimbrels flew by just down the lagoon, Burnham Lagoon, and things like that. So all in all, it was very enjoyable, lovely outing.
Excellent.
Then things move on, like, you know, I suppose in a way Dawn Chorus is beginning to quieten down a bit now, because some of the birds are very busy feeding and their chicks in the nest, and others are nearly finished nesting, you know. So just to kind of run through what people might have around, maybe start off with the smallest bird. Our smallest bird is actually the goldcrest, and they're only about 8 or 9 centimetres long, and weigh about 5 to 8 grams. Very, very small bird. Olive green with two black stripes on their crown, with gold yellow centre on it. And they love evergreen areas, evergreen forests, coniferous areas and so on. Just reading the other day, their lives are lived in miniature. The nests are exquisite, made from moss, feathers, spiders, webs. And they can have up to a dozen eggs, and they're barely bigger than peas.
Whoa.
And they use the underside of spruce or fir branch as a nesting site. And any conifer, really, if there are any has evergreen trees around the house, keep an eye out, that could be on them, you know. Their thin beaks have evolved to pick out the insects between the fine needles. But in a really, really bad winter, an awful lot of them die, but they recover fairly quickly because they have fairly big broods. They can have up to 10 or 12 eggs in the nest, you know. So they're our smallest bird. And then, I suppose, around nearly every house, I'd say, somewhere near your house, you probably have a wren. Now, the wren is slightly bigger, maybe 9, 10 centimetres in length. and maybe a little bit heavier, maybe up to 13 grams, and it goes on like, it flies on like a little mouse, and has a big burst of song, might have a go at just playing the song there, George, just to see if you can hear it there on the thing. Just have a go at that. That's... They usually go twice, and you hear there's a little trill at the end of the song.
Hmm.
But that should be, they'd be singing away now, because they'll nest up into kind of July. They're probably two broods anyway, you know. And when they do fly the nest, it's kind of funny. I remember it happened to me a couple of years ago, back at the house. There was been a wren's nest nearby, and the young kicked through the nest. Of course, they'd never seen a human. One perched on top of my head, another perched into my hand, and the parent bird was gone. Bird berserk, because I was saying, get away from that fella, he's dangerous, you know. But they had no idea what it was. And now, neither the goldcrest or the wrens, they won't come to feeders. You know, you might see them in the garden, but they won't come to feeders. But then you have blue tits and grey tits who are kind of finishing up nest. They only have one brood. And blue tits, you find them in nest boxes if you use them sometimes. Unused litter boxes, holes in stone walls, any place they can find a safe cavity. In Clare, they call them the Clare bird because of the Clare colours. And they lay a lot of eggs because they're only one brood. They could be up from between 7 to 16 eggs in the nest. Now, they don't always succeed in rearing those chicks. If one of the parent birds gets killed, for example, or some gets for the cat catches it or whatever, the other bird won't succeed on its own. The chicks are born kind of to coincide with the availability of moth and butterfly caterpillars. So if the timing is out, that would, you know, get in the way of rearing the chicks as well. The great tish, again, one brood, 5 to 11 eggs around the same time. They both of those come to feed. The great tish is the one with the black tie always in mourning. It's the black tie and it says teacher call. That's just kind of a song. And then you'd have, I suppose, the one that maybe would be singing the latest, because the nest into July, that you would commonly drop across with black caps. And the black caps we have now come from Africa. We have black caps in the winter, but they come from Eastern Europe and they go back there to breed. And they always sing from cover. They could go up to three broods, maybe 4 or 5 eggs in each nest, right up to July. And then they feed on insects from the foliage in the greenery. And they also like fleshy berries, things that like the elder. Mm. Now, the male is a grey bird with a black cap, and the female is a grey bird with a rusty, kind of a brownish-red cap. And then, I suppose, everyone was familiar with the robin.
Yeah.
They'd have two broods, maybe from between April and August, and they feed on spiders and insects and warm berries and seeds. And the juvenile robin, by the way, doesn't have a red breast because it's the parent bird that is sharing the territory which would not tolerate it if it had a red breast. They can't tolerate anything with red in their territory. So the juvenile bird, the robin, has a speckled brown breast. You might see them around the garden at this time. We might try and play the sound of the robin. That's very, would be very common to people, and people would hear it quite a lot.
Hmm.
And they usually stop and listen then. And the thing again, the stop and listen is there to see is there any other robin nearby you, coming into their territory, you know?
Yeah, so they're warning then, all the time.
Yes, that's kind of they're checking that my territory is safe. Then the border would be common enough with chaffinch. They only have one brood, but we don't know this time of the year. The reddish colours and white wing bars and things like that. People would be familiar with them, and they eat caterpillar seeds and so on. They would come to garden feeders as well. People would see them at their feeders in the wintertime. And of course, everyone probably knows the starling. They're a bit bigger than the last bird we mentioned now. They nest in holes, and they'll create a hole if masonry is loose, and they'll go in under slates and in attics, and you know, they can be a bit of a nuisance. But a lot of them have finished up breeding now, and that you'd see, if you see a flock of starlings now, you'll see the juvenile started with them, the duller, the browner birds. I saw a flock of over 1,000 the other day in Island of Anna, of adult and juvenile birds. And Starling can mimic, and so he's the one now that people that use the Merlin Cardinal app to identify bird song. Very often the Starling is the guy that confuses the Merlin app and tells you that it's some bird in America that you're listening to.
Yeah.
American Robin or something like that. It's the Starling doing the various songs that has picked up and mimicked and so on. Other things can put the app off as well. It's generally very good. It's good for the common bird, but sometimes it'll be telling you that you have things like, I know someone lately that knew they hadn't, a Canadian goose and so on, but every day it was, they put out the app, or on the app it was saying Canadian goose, but she discovered an into a baby babbling. The child was babbling and it was saying Canadian goose. So you just want to be careful with it.
Just before you go on, I was just thinking there, you know, the bird species that have, say, more than one brood, how does that work in the nest? Do they kind of encourage the chicks to get going before the next one, or would they raise a few together?
No. Usually what happens is, we'll take a robin as an example. They'll make a nest, we'll say, in the hedge or in the shade or whatever, and they'll rear those chicks, that chick or two or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they'll make another nest somewhere else, and they'll try and rear the second brood from that. They usually don't go back to the same nest because nests get full of ticks and different things, you know. So the swallows would go back to the same nest and house martins and things like that, but the ones I've mentioned up to now wouldn't.
Yeah.
Now, the starling might, if they were stuck for nesting sites, but they'd kind of clean it out a bit and things, and they'd rearrange it. But a lot of them, if they are to have a second blackbird or a song thrush, right, that they usually build a second nest coming on there to the song thrush. People will be familiar with it, and they remember we said the last day that whatever it sings, and they are singing at the moment, it repeats. So maybe we'll have a listen just to song, which is a fine, strong singer, and people would be familiar with it, you know. There's a repetition there, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever it says it again. And then the backbone, I suppose, so all the choruses is the blackbird, really. And they feed on worms and insects and invertebrates and things like that. The song thrush, by the way, if you find a stone in your garden or a piece of concrete or something, and there are a lot of snail shells around it, that's the song thrush's anvil, because it brings the snail to that particular stone, and they break the shell and get out the snail to eat it. And the blackbird hasn't learned that trick, but it has learned the trick to hide in the hedge. And when the song thrush has broken the snail out of the shell, it will ambush the song thrush and take the snail.
Amazing. So
it has its own way of doing it.
Yeah, Tom, stay with us, because we have to go to a break. But we'll be talking more with Tom after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
Now we're here with Tom Lynch of Birdwatch Ireland, and also Dingle native. And we always love having Tom on to talk about the birds. And before the break, Tom, we were talking about the blackbird.
Yeah, I said the blackbird is the kind of the cornerstone of the John chorus, and that they are singing. People would be familiar with them. We'll just try and have a listen to the blackbird song. That people would know this song.
Yeah.
No, that's the fluty song, rumbly fluty song of the blackbird.
It's so strong, isn't it?
It's very strong, strong. And you know, it's uncommon, you know, that really, really, I suppose, signifies spring, summer to a lot of people in the road for a walk or whatever. You'll hear a blackbird singing. Blackbird song thrushes, they're probably two of our better singers. Now we have many more, you know, singing around Willow Arbor, Chief Jazz, Mr. Thrushes and so on. People are looking out for something else. A lot of people this year have told me they've heard the cuckoo, even in West Kerry. It's been a good number of people have said they heard a cuckoo. One report of a contrary. A friend of mine heard a contrary in Dunquin one morning, and that was it. That was it. People went to hear it. It didn't stick around.
Yeah.
I seemed to come in one night, and it was back the back of Sean O'Quarter's house back in Dunquin.
Yeah, that's positive, though, isn't it?
Well, they reckon they won a concrete bread back there last year, like.
Yeah.
Or maybe even two, you know, in West Kerry. But this one didn't, was only passing through, probably on its way to up the coast to Mayo or to Donegal. The only place that you'll see the concretes clearly is in Tory, where there isn't much cover. They come out and they perch up on walls and they do their sound away. But usually they sink from cover. Mm. Usually they'll be in the middle. But they are really, really scarce. And I suppose the last birds really to nest would be things like greenfinch and linnets. And if you're lucky enough to be in a place where they are, people, listeners in Cork, maybe in the border place like that, the yellowhammer, they begin to nest now and they nest away into August, kind of. Maybe them again, that some of them would have two broods, you know. So, but it's... You're probably at the height of the nesting season in a way now, you know, the last 2 weeks and the next week or two. And it will then, when the nesting is over and the chicks have fledged and so on, the next thing that happens with the birds is they go into molt. They get a new set of feathers, not all together, bit by bit. So they kind of, during July, it's usually very quiet and the skulls go away. They don't show themselves off when they're molting because they're not at their best. Mm. And they don't want the neighbours seeing them and so on. So people say sometimes in July, there are no birds around, all right, but they're even already, you'll probably notice there's rooks around missing a feather here and there. They've started molting already because they've bred earlier on, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the cycle. And then it begins all over again, you know. Migration then for some birds and new birds coming in the autumn, and then was on and stuff up all over again then with your song thrush you're singing again in November. So.
Yeah, and Tom, we were talking about during the week, you know, like there's no disguising the fact that the weather has been fairly poor now with the last 6 months or more with a poor winter, and now the summer is only all right. Has that affected the birds or how are the numbers? What are you hearing?
Well, if heavy downpours of rain are the worst, really, because they flood the nest, and the chicks don't have the waterproof feathers that the adult birds have, and they've a covering of down, and they get cold and suffer kind of hypothermia, and the adult bird find it hard to keep them warm, and they spend more time in the nest and less time foraging for food, and it can affect breeding. The heavy rain is probably the worst of all, cold and heavy rain. Now, a friend of mine at Birdwatcher, John Murphy, said he reckons it was a fairly good enough year for breeding birds in general. He thought the only one that kind of seemed to be down, now he travels around a good bit, was the black cap. The black caps were down in places, but they're still there. Yeah, he's probably right. Where I'd walk, usually, last year I might have heard 7, 8, 9 black caps singing. This year just 3 or 4. But other than that, he seems to think that the more common birds, blackbirds and songthrushes and robins and wrens and all that, they're doing reasonably well. I suppose the cold weather does affect the amount of insect available. Mm. Now, at the same time, it wasn't really, really cold, I suppose, so there was an availability of certain amount of insect. But now with the improvement of weather, will definitely be welcomed by us as humans, but also by the birds, because it'll make it easier.
Yeah.
Just makes it easier to find the food, you know, when the weather is better. Now, if it's too dry and too fine, that's the problem as well. But that's a problem that didn't exist this year. I knew about a couple of very warm days ago, but that was no problem. That was short lived.
Mm.
So it makes kind of weather is best really for a breeding season.
Yeah, yeah.
And then of course they have all the other hazards, the birds of prey and the cats and magpies and hooded crows, and they want to deal with all those things as well. Like, you know, it's one thing to feed the chicks, and suddenly some magpie finds the nest, and the chicks are nearly due to fledge, and the magpie will go off with them. So all your effort can be in vain.
Yeah. And come here to me now, Tom, the magpie. And I often, you know, we talk about this poem, one for sorrow, two for joy, three to get married, yeah. four to die, it keeps going. Is a magpie a solitary bird, or do they go off in pairs? Or like, it's always, you seem to always see one for sorrow at the moment. And I'm always looking for the other one.
Once they're finished nesting, they would often go off on their own, which this time of the year now, you would have the magpies nesting, and they nest up on trees, and clever enough, they put a roof on their nest so that other predators can't come along and pick the chicks out of the nest. But they'd go off and search for other bird's nests and pick out eggs and chicks out of their nest.
Yeah.
But they're common nesters close to houses and tall trees and evergreen trees, deciduous trees. They'll nest up high, and then that's kind of bad news for birds in the neighbourhood, because they'd be searching for food for their own chicks and for themselves. So, which you will see, you know, two together, and you'll see three and four. Seldom enough time you'll see the seven or five for silver, six for gold, seven for a secret, never to be told. Seldom enough that happens, you know. But it can if there was a lot of carrion or something, or a roadkill. Sometimes you will see a lot of magpies.
Yeah, very good. Tom, stay with us, because we're going to be talking about the seabirds, but we're going to go to a break, and we'll have more from Tom after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney. Serving the finest seafood in a cosy, modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
Now, Tom Lynch is still with us, birdwatch expert. And Tom, we were talking the last time you were on about the puffin, we got us talking about other sea birds, but we didn't have time to go into them in depth. But we have some amazing seabirds around our coast, some of the best in the world.
We have lovely seabird colonies, the Outer Blaskids, the Skelligs, Puffin Island, Loophead, Diffsmoor, Salties, Ratlet Island, places like that all around the coast. On these you have they won't all be in every one of them, but you have breeding puffins, for example, we'll say, in the Skelligs, and you have them in the Cliffs of Moher. The Cliffs of Moher is actually the only place you can see breeding puffins from the land. You don't actually have to go out in the boat to see them. Yeah. If you walk up from the visitor centre of the Cliffs of Moher and go left and look down, there's a little island called Goat Island. The puffins are nesting down there and burrows. But you have puffins, and then you have the gannets, of course, huge colony on the little Skellig. Before the bird flu came along, there were up to 30,000 gannets on that. Now, the bird flu did reduce the numbers a bit, but I think the numbers are going back up again. And then you have the Manx shearwater and the Star and Petrel breeding in the Blaskids and other parts of South Kerry as well. And then you have in the colonies, then in Loophead and there's some more again, you have kittiwakes and guillemots and razorbills. And nearby, very often, and sometimes on their own, you're just calling these a fulmer.
Mm.
Now, the fulmer is not, they look like a seagull, but they're not. They're actually closely related to the albatross.
Okay.
They're about, I suppose, that 45, 50 centimetres. They glide, they don't flap as much as the seagull. Seagulls flap a lot, these glide along, and they have just one egg, one brood. There's a small little colony of them there in Beanbarn, just outside Dingle. They used to have 20 nests in it as you approach Beanbarn Head, if you look down. But in recent years, it's only five or six nests, you know. We didn't have farmers at all up to the beginning of the 1900s, but they came south following whaling ships, and they've bred successfully here since.
Really?
So that's one too. And they're tube-nosed. And to get too close to a fulmer's nest particularly, they spit out this oil, and it gets on your claws. You'll never, no matter how many times you wash it, you'll never get that oily, fishy smell out of them. The lads that ring birds, you know, that ring, and if they catch fulmers, they put them on the ringing bags, you know, keep them quiet until they ring them.
Yeah.
They can never get the smell. No matter how many times the bag, I've seen bags that were washed 20 times, and the smell of the fulmer, the oily smell from the the Fulmer's nose, tube nose, is steel from the bay, you know.
Whoa.
So that's the Fulmer.
Yeah.
The Manx shearwater, they came out at sea, they need to come back to the nest and recover adapters, because the great blackback gulls and the herring gulls and things pick them off. They come back and they make this eerie, very unusual sound. Anyone that's spent a night on the coast where they're nesting, you know, it's just very, very eerie, ghostly sound. And then if storm petrels, Mother Carey's chickens, as they're called, that look at times as if they're walking on the water. They're a small little bird, only 14, 17 centimetres. And if they'll accidentally land on the ground, they cannot take off. So if you find one of them, you have to launch it into the air. Can't take off. It has a very, very short little legs.
Really?
And again, one brood, one egg, and nest in holes and rocks or an old wall or a burrow. And they feed on fish offal or fish oil or marine invertebrates. That's what they're doing when they're walking in the water. They're trying to pick little invertebrates off from the water. And they have a lifespan of about 20 years. And they're actually on the logo of the Kerry GA jersey. That little squiggle of a bird that's on it. That's meant to be a star and petrel, because we have internationally very, very big breeding numbers in Kerry, so that's the link with the
and 20 years, is that like compared to other birds? What, that seems long, does it?
Well, sea birds generally live like, you know, Manx shearwater would be something similar, kittiwakes, things like that. They lots of them live, some of them will be 10 years. Maybe something like a black guillemot would be 10 years. But then a razorbill would be 10 to 20 years. A guillemot would be 10 to 20 years, you know. The seabirds tend to be longer living than the likes of the blackbirds and the songthrushes and the robins we were talking about, because their lifespan is a couple of years. Maybe 5 is very long for a long time for a robin to be around, whereas the seabirds, they're hardy, they're tough, they go off out to sea for the winter, you know, and the gannets would have a lifespan of 16 to 20 years, and you know, as we said, the big numbers are little skelligs. Gannets have a wingspan of 1.6 to 1.8 metres and 5.5 to 6 foot wingspan, you know, that's very big. And again, one egg, one brood.
And the gannets, sorry Tom to cut across you, but I remember I used to caddy in the Waterville Golf Links, and you'd see them fishing out in the ocean.
Yeah.
And the way they just, all of a sudden, before they'd hit the water, they'd go into like an arrow and they'd just shoot down into the water. It was the most impressive thing ever.
Oh yeah, they'd go shooting down to catch mackerel or a pollock, and they can go down, sometimes they go on a shallow sloping dive, but very often there's the one you were describing, a vertical dive from a great height.
Yeah.
And the gannets have forward-facing eyes and a kind of cushioned head and neck to equip it to pinpoint fast-moving fish and then dive headlong to catch it. They have no nostrils, because if they had, they'd blow out their brains.
Pressure, you know,
the pressure that hit the water on. Frank King had a great story about them, that I think when himself and Des Lavelle were going into the skelly one day, that there was a gannet in the water and had a fish hook or something stuck in it. Hmm. So they decided to kind of rescue the gannet, so that pulled over near it and they managed to catch it. And while they were trying to sort it out, all the gannets got off little skelly and circled over them like a huge cloud of snow. Hmm. Basically, they didn't attack them, but they were just curious as to see what was going on, you know.
Yeah.
And then once they released the gannet, they all settled back on the rock again. Gannets typically seen as a brilliant white bird offshore, circling and then diving for fish, as you described, you know, that's what most people say. But that white bird, you see, it takes it 4 years to go from being a chick to that brilliant white bird. At certain stages, it's actually quite black in its first, second year, that kind of thing, you know. The white bird you're seeing is 4 years old or more. So, and then if fishing is good near them, they won't travel too far from the nest, but then they can travel way up, you know. You'd see them, the gannets on the skelly. People back in Dingle will see gannets passing people up North Kerry, even up Loophead. You'd see gannets, and they're the gannets, they're up there fishing and flying. They're a big bird, they can fly quickly.
Yeah.
It's not that, it's just distance, but the nest is just a pile of seaweed or debris now, very often plastic. And the only mix-up you would have with them is be probably an immature great black gull. And again, it's immature gannet can kind of look the same, but they are very striking in terms of that.
And can the gannet get injured when they're fishing? I thought I heard that. I was an urban myth that they can nearly break their neck when they're going in.
If it's going straight into water, they won't. But if they make a mistake,
yes.
If they do make a mistake and there's a rock or something there, they can't. But it's rare enough. I've seen them diving. They always either come up with a fish or come up with nothing, but they come up and they fly away and they're off.
And they can see the fish from that height, is it?
They can, yeah. They're brilliant eyesight, and they have this big lovely eye and the yellow buff head.
Yeah.
And the black wingtips, and they circle around. That you see them circling around. They like they're trying to locate the pollock or the mackerel or whatever is that they're trying to catch. And then once they're home in on it, they dive down and bang. And some of the dives are successful, some are not. You know, it varies. But generally, they seem to be very successful. As I said, the only thing that really affected them was that bird flu. A lot of them washed up, did that same. Now, you'll always get a dead seabird. You know, you'll get a dead razor bill or a guillemot or a gannet, whatever. That happens.
Yeah.
Various reasons why it can happen. But it's when you see a number together, that's the time then you start getting worried. And we say to people as well, don't be handling dead birds really now, because you never know with this bird flu.
And the seabirds, they don't seem to be as good as singers as their garden cousins.
No, they seem to
be louder. I don't know, is that because of the ocean and everything? But
they're not singers. I mean, take the gannet as kind of a regular rhythmic throaty chorus at the nest. They're silent at sea.
Yeah.
If you near the we'd say little skelly, you'll hear this regular kind of a throaty kind of a sound, you know, that keep it's a very throaty, gurgly kind of thing. They keep at that all the time, but you couldn't, I suppose, maybe to them it's a song, which to us wouldn't be described as a song anyway, you know. The kittiwake is one now, it kind of says its name, kittiwake, they're their smallest gull.
Yeah.
They're and they'd nest, you would have, say, if you take loop head now, you would have no puffins in loop head, but you have kittiwakes and you have rays of bill and guillemots, and you'd have fulmar. And then nearby, the gulls, things like great black gulls and herring gulls, very often nest not too far away from those seabird colonies, because they want to be near the restaurant, because they want to come down, and when the seabird is looking, take an egg or take a chick. And that's, you know, the seabird eggs very often are just laid on a ledge.
Mm.
And one of the birds, the parent birds, has to be there all the time, really. They're made in such a way they won't roll off. They spin around rather than rolling off. They're not like the egg that you have in the kitchen.
Don't
you
be put smooth.
It on the counter, and you're suddenly picking it up off the floor.
Yeah.
But it's that they're made in such a way that they will stay on the ledge. And then, of course, what the great blackback gulls do, and herring gulls, and there's some blackback gulls if they're around, or when they do come around, a lot of them are off breeding. But what they do is they're watching for an unattended chick, an unattended egg, and then in and it's gone. So that's one of the hazards that the seabirds have to watch out for. You'd often find as well, if you're near seabird colonies, you would have maybe tuff nesting in the cliff, you know, and little cavities in the cliff and so on. They're a member of the crow family with the red bill, the red legs, and they kind of say their name as well, that's kind of a tuff sound. They breed good numbers breeding in along the coast, the coast of Ireland, Kerry, Clare, Cork, all the way up along, you know. Now, they wouldn't be near as plentiful as the thousands of seabirds, but it's a kind of a stronghold for them, the west coast and the south coast. So they're just things to look out for when you're by the watching a seabird colony, that they may be there as well, or maybe nesting shag as well. They can be close enough to a seabird colony. And then even on the rocky area, things you might get green clover, swan nesting, you know, there's very little things to look out for when you're walking along this time of the year. The ring plover don't make a nest either. They just they disguise their eggs in among the gravel or the rocks and hope that, and when they see you, they go off. Put their, by the way, they have a broken wing and they run away, you know, to distract you away from the nest of the chicks if they're born.
Yeah, you know, seagulls, Tom, they've got a bad rap, especially around urban areas in recent times. And, like, why are they so different to other seabirds that they seem to come inland and they seem to be more opportunistic? They're the ones that kind of follow the fishing boats and, you know, they'd go maybe to where the rubbish bins are or, you know, they seem to be more... Is it because they're more intelligent or what is it? Why would
I think that the number of things there that... The black bags of rubbish, actually, they used to attack the black bags and they used to take the food out of them, but the bacteria had formed and the food, you know, with the heat and so on, and they'd got this botulism from it and they killed a lot of herring gulls there. But then when the wheelie bins came along, that seemed to not be as much of a problem for them. What happened with a lot of them when they moved in, like, a lot of them, I suppose, maybe some of their nesting sites were kind of taken over or destroyed, and then they moved in and they started nesting on flat roofs and things like that, you know. People started feeding them, and then they saw people as a source of food, and then they got cheekier and cheekier, and suddenly someone is out having his or her sandwich, and they have one eye on the phone and the sandwich in their hand, and suddenly the herring gull says, this person is going to feed me, and they grab the sandwich.
Yeah.
You know, so that happened actually at the farmer's market this morning. I saw this guy with his big cheese doll, and a rook came along and took a big lump of cheese. You know, so it's not confined to the herring gulls. But as they get, I think there was a film there on YouTube where the herring gull had learned the opening doors, automatic doors in the shop. Yeah. Where inside the door of the shop were bags of crisps, and when you just walk up to the door and go in and grab a bag of crisps, that they had to move actually the crisps away from the door of the shop. So that they're opportunistic, that they have no fear, and that, you know, that they see us, I suppose. And then people, you know, around fast food outlets and so on, people leave food that they didn't finish, they leave, and some people actually throw chips and bits of fast food to them. So that's kind of encouraging them too, you know. So there's no doubt about that, a nuisance, especially if you have children out in a picnic or something like that. I mean, you know, or even yourself, you have to just be aware that if they're around, that these guys can grab the food, or, you know, that. It is a problem. There's no doubt. And then for people in Dublin, particularly where they're nesting on the flat roofs and so on, they're up very early in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and they're just walking and making a racket.
Yeah.
People are losing sleep over it. So there's no doubt about that. People are trying to get them not to nest close to them, putting various things on the roof to try and deter them. But
just
to get around them too.
In a word, because we're out of time, but where do the gannets go?
Well, the gannets go off out to sea in the wintertime.
Yeah, and do they sleep then? Like out in the ocean, is it?
On the water, yeah.
Yeah,
on the water, yeah. And the same with the puffin now. They go off out to sea, off in the Atlantic, and some go south to Spain and off Spain and places like that. But they could go... They can go from miles and miles offshore.
Yeah.
The only small birds that do that in very bad weather are the swifts. If there's a really, really bad weather, and they feed on insects, and there are no insects, they go off outside the weather for maybe 200 miles offshore, and the chicks and eggs go into sort of a stupor for maybe couple of days until they come back with a crop of food. But they're the only ones that do that. With the gannets, they rear their chicks by fishing close enough to where the nest is, and then when the when the chick is reared, the chick goes off,
yeah,
and they go off as well. Then may go out together first, but then split up, you know.
Yeah, very good. I'm just reminded of when we're talking about the seagulls, there was a cartoon years ago. There was like, they were saying that the seagulls were saying, mine, 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 about everything. They thought they owned everything. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks a million for coming on again and telling us all about this fascinating bird kingdom. It's just absolutely amazing, the evolution and the way they can adapt and everything else. And Tom, before we go, you wanted to tell me about a new app that's out there for people that are into their birds?
If people want to listen to bird sound, there's an app. It's a free app. It's www.dk.com/bird-song.
Okay.
And you can, and now, people that have the Collins Bird Guide on their phone, they have sound that comes with all the sounds as well. I think it's €18 to download that, but the one I called out, that is free. www.tk.com/bird-song.
Excellent. Yeah. Brilliant, Tom. A pleasure as always, and thanks a million for coming on and talking to us again this morning.
Thanks, Joe. Okay.
We're going to take a break. We'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963.
Now we're into the second hour of the Saturday Supplement, and I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. If you want to get in touch with me during the week, you can email me, jmcgill@radiokerry.ie. A reminder, our In Focus photography slot, the theme was capturing a moment or capturing the moment. So it's quite broad. So get your thinking caps on, and you can email them to jmcgill@radiokerry.ie before midday Wednesday, before the first Saturday of the month. Now, the Oral History Network of Ireland aims to promote oral history practice in Ireland, connect all practitioners, both community and academic, share resources, promote oral history's value, host annual conferences, provide training, and advocate for legislative protection and support sustainable voice archives through best practices. Its annual meeting or conference is being held in Tralee this year on June 18th and 19th, with a special event open and free to members of the public on the Friday evening. And here to tell us more about OHNI and talk a little more about oral history, what it is and why it's important in safeguarding our history and how it is best practiced, with me today are members of Oral History Network of Ireland. We have Daniel Carey, who is the conference organiser. We have Roisin Jones, who is an OHNI administrator. And Linda Fitzgibbon is an oral historian and committee member. And of course, we have Dr. Fiona Brennan, who is an ONHI membership officer. And before I talk to Linda and Daniel, Fiona, it feels like ages since I've been talking to you. How have things been going with you?
I've been very well, George. I haven't been hammering down your door for a while. Everything is really, really good. We're very, very, very excited about this event in Kerry. It's great to have it coming to Kerry.
Brilliant. So, Linda, if I can start with yourself, what is oral history?
Well, I guess there's no real one definition, but it's just a way to preserve the stories of our past. You know, it's the lives of people. People love to tell a story, I guess, especially if you're from Kerry. Everybody loves the story. And it's a personal testimony, but basically oral history is a way to capture the stories, but to also preserve them, preserve the stories of our past and to gather them, because they're valuable life stories that if we don't gather these stories and collect them and preserve them, they'll be lost and gone forever.
Mm, it's a ticking time bomb, isn't it, really?
It really is, because the whole thing is about, it's about memory. It's recorded memory, you know. So the way that we do that as oral historians, it's very important to listen, to just listen and have really so much respect for the person, because the person it's a dialogue between you and the person, like you do every day. You know, that dialogue is so important, but it's to document their experiences. But oral history is basically, like, the person is the primary source in oral history.
Mm.
And it's historical, you know, like we do it to collect it for historical memory is important, and to listen to those memories. And sometimes, and you probably know that yourself because you do this every day, is the silences are sometimes as important as what's actually said, you know?
Yeah.
So it's basically memory.
Yeah. It's so true. The catch in someone's throat, you know, when they're talking about something maybe that's very emotional to them, can tell a lot more than, you know, a full paragraph or, you know, a lot longer conversation.
That's right. And to allow those silences, you know, because sometimes when people are collecting or, you know, just, you know, recording, because it's important to record it, because that's what we do is record them. But to just sit with the silence, because sometimes people are processing those memories, and just even something that they might have said to you before might trigger some little memory that they have. So it's important to give people that time to just to allow that story to emerge, you know, to actually then the beauty of oral history is you just can capture that.
Yeah.
You can, you know, keep it for so they can, you know, we can share it later on, but it's before it's gone. Sometimes people don't even know they have that memory inside them.
Yeah. Listeners to this program are well used to me saying now, when an old person dies, a library burns. And that's when we're teaching classes in broadcasting and we do oral history projects. That's what I write up on top of the board. When an old person dies, a library burns, because all that is gone and lost forever.
That's it, exactly. That's and to capture that, you know, that whole idea is the memory and the power of memory. It's so precious. You know, there's this radio announcer, Stubbs Terkel, and he says, you know, when somebody gives you their memory, when you're collecting a story, it's like you're being given a precious thing. And you just take it and realize that it is that precious thing, that memory is so precious.
Mm.
And, you know, that you're privileged to share that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great way of saying it. It is a privilege. Daniel, can you tell us, what is the Oral History Network of Ireland?
Yes, Joe. Well, the Oral History Network of Ireland, or ONI, as we call ourselves, O-H-N-I, we're an organisation that supports anyone who's interested in recording or collecting or preserving oral history. So we offer guidance on how to approach an oral history project using what we call the life cycle approach. So that's recording, research, recording, editing, archiving and dissemination. So a lot of the people that come to us have an idea that they want to conduct interviews, gather stories, talk to people in their locality. And I suppose one of the things that we stress is that before you do the interview, that you think about what you want to do before that and what you want to do afterwards as well. So we do training for community groups and for and at academics, and try and connect oral historians in different parts of the country and beyond. So that's kind of the networking element comes in, and the event that we'll have in Tralee, annual event. We have been calling it a conference, and then we've rebranded in the last year or two as an annual meeting. So it's very much an open house for anyone who's interested in preserving and documenting stories of the past.
Roisin, you have a fairly comprehensive website there as well.
We do, yes. We very recently relaunched the website. We're very lucky to have had funding from the Heritage Council in the past. And thanks to that funding, we were able to work with a fantastic company up in Donegal to rebrand and to give the website a different look, to make it really accessible to people. Because a lot of people, in my experience, will, you know, maybe not necessarily have heard of oral history, but as, you know, Linda so eloquently explained there, what it really is, it's listening to people, it's sharing stories, it's stories from below, you know, it's capturing people's memory. So we're trying to help the website look more like that, so it's more appealing to people. If you're interested in oral history, you can come along and have a look at it. There's a lot on there about our membership, how you can join the organisation. It's open to absolutely everyone. Also more on our training and the different types of training that we offer throughout the year, whether it's online or in person. There's also subject to resources, bespoke training that we can also offer. We have a lot of groups that get in touch with us who come directly to us, almost as the first stop to ask about training and what they need to know. So we give advice on that. We really like to add more to this, like to showcase people's oral history projects on the website. So again, if you're interested in it and you think, oh, well, could I create this project or what have other people done, you can look on there and it's, you know, the wealth, the diversity of stories that are there as well. And so that's really wonderful. And we very recently set up what we're calling our regional network of volunteers, our leads across Ireland, because as Daniel was saying there, you know, this is the networking, it's the network across all Ireland. And we just want to reach out to as many people as possible. So we're certainly using the website in that way to link different parts of the country together so that they could have someone local in their area to approach and talk to. And it's also home to our listings for all of our events. So it's a busy little website.
Yeah, excellent. And, you know, it's great that it provides such a platform for people as well. Daniel, getting back to the training, it is kind of vital, isn't it, when it comes to oral history and oral history best practice?
Yeah, so a lot of people who come to ONI for training want to do interviews with people in their local community, or maybe they've already done interviews and they kind of think after the fact maybe there's a better way of doing this. So we on the one hand we do emphasise that we're, you know, by doing things and by bringing expertise into the room together, we can kind of pass on what we've learned from things we've done well and things we've done badly. So we emphasize best practice in the interviewing part, but not just the interviewing part. So the importance of doing research beforehand, not kind of going in just half cocked, having an idea of what it is you want to talk to the person about. Also think about how or where you might archive the interview, and also how you get it out in the world. So for community people, that might be making material available in your local library or in a community booklet or putting material online. There's also in the era of GDPR, there's a whole host of ethical and legal considerations, and we go through those in detail on in our training as well. As Roisin says, our training is kind of a mixture of open calls, which could be targeted specifically at academics or at community groups, and we also do bespoke training. So if there's a group in a certain area that are thinking about a project, that are looking to do things the right way from the beginning, we try and accommodate that as well, and have people we do training online, but we also offer it in person as well.
And the conference details then as well, Daniel, can you give us a bit more information on that?
It's a two-day gathering of oral historians from various parts of Ireland and beyond. So this year we're in the Meadowlands Hotel in Tralee on the 18th and 19th of June. The theme is oral history and movement. So we'll have a series of presentations from both community people and academics on that broad topic. We'll also have workshops on how to do oral history better. And we'll have a keynote address from Mary Stewart, who's the oral history curator at the British Library in London. I got a sneak preview of Mary's keynote last week, and it's going to be amazing.
Excellent. Fiona, you know, we're always thinking about ourselves, you know, the Kerry people. What's the Kerry connection in all of this, though? What can we expect?
Oh, we're not. We're very selfless altogether. We're always thinking of others. But there's the beauty about... or the Oral History Network of Ireland is the, I suppose, we're very different in that we want and care passionately about the community engagement. So the annual meeting moves to different parts, different corners in the country every year. And it was in Limerick last year. So what we try and do is emphasise the oral history projects that are going on in the locality or the county. So hence the connection this year with the Kerry Writers Museum. Kerry Writers Museum is celebrating its 25th anniversary of its opening. So as well as, say, the oral history aspect of it, I was involved, say, in the oral history project and amateur drama there a couple of years ago with them. We're just celebrating what they have, because they have a magnificent collection of kind of both oral and archival history. So Cara Trant, who's the executive director at the museum, is going to be speaking on that special panel. Jimmy Deanahan, former government minister, everybody will know Jimmy well. He's also speaking as well because he's a board member, and I suppose he's been there since the foundations basically were being dug. So that's going to be very, very exciting. And that's one of the events that we throw open to the public on the Friday evening.
Excellent. Linda, what's your advice to those wishing to set up an oral history project themselves?
Well, for me, I'm really passionate about community-based oral history, you know, and that's part of what we in ONI do is to support community to gather the stories and, you know, preserve them before they're lost. I keep saying that. But I mean, as you said, you know, that library burning down, I mean, it's happening all around us all the time. And so the idea is to help the community to actually to do the skills. Like, one of the things is that gathering, people say, oh, you know, I don't think I'd be able to do that. Everybody can do it. But the most important thing is to do it properly in that. And that's why, you know, ONI provide training, but we also have a network. That's the whole idea is community support. And, you know, come along to the conference because it's in Kerry. I'm from Cork. Am I allowed to say that? I don't know. So but the thing is that it's, We that's what we are to advocate. We're an advocate. We're an advocate for oral history and heritage. And the important thing is to start and to get a little bit of help at the beginning, and then support when you want to just to do it ethically. Because there's a way of doing it. Consent forms, a few things. They're not that complicated. But if you start, as you mean to go on, and that's what we're here for. And actually, that day that Fiona was explaining, it's it's free. So hopefully, all your listeners will come.
Yeah, and that's important, Linda. You know, that professional aspect of it, consent forms, things like that. Because I think that's what often scares people about maybe beginning a project like this. You know, they think, oh, I can interview, I'd be able to, but I'd be afraid of, you know, the technical or the legal kind of aspect of it. So that's important to touch on that as well.
I think so, because I mean, I think we, you know, as Irish people, we're kind of trained. It's like, oh God, we can't do that. You're not sure we can't. We wouldn't be able to do that. And then, you know, when somebody passes away, sadly, and then they say, oh, like, why didn't we collect their stories? And it's not difficult. It's just, it's important to kind of do it properly. And that's what we're here for. And I think we now have the recording equipment is so much better than, I don't know how they did it long ago, you know, logging around tapes. But I mean, you can get, and we actually now provide, we provide people with equipment if they don't have it. So we're here to actually help collect the stories, because the ONI's mission is to support people and to support the collection of oral history and heritage in Ireland.
I also think that people are getting more used of being interviewed or you know, talking as well than they did before. And that also helps, I'd imagine, with trying to capture this.
I think so. And you know, Rogine actually is available because we're lucky enough now to actually have Rogine with the website. So you know, if you email, you're going to get an email back. And then, you know, Daniel has been leading some networking events that we can do it online. So you don't even have to actually physically come. Mm. But I think the most important thing is for us, we're advocate for protection of oral history and heritage in Ireland. And, you know, it's all people, young people, old people, gathering the things that they did long ago with their copybooks. You know, they went home and gathered material, which is now so valuable to us. And we can do that again.
Mm. And do you get a lot of themes and things like that? I know when we did one down in South Kerry, we had like the Fair Days, and we kind of gathered around that theme. It was actually excellent because it kind of focused people, and they were able to gather loads of historical and social economic information and everything like that. It kind of helps in that aspect as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, we say oral history, you know, what we've kind of been saying now really is it's oral heritage, because oral history is that first person narrative. And then, you know, folklore is, you know, traditions, I suppose. And so it's oral history and oral history interviews. You know yourself, you do interviews all the time. It always touches on all those things. So that's why it's kind of, we just say, we're talking about being oral history and heritage together, and just to help people capture all those stories, because memory is at the core, but the people are the primary source. The person is the primary source. And, you know, everybody's got stories to tell and every story is valuable.
Yeah, very good. We'll take a break and we'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals available in store.
Now we're talking about the Oral History Network of Ireland and they have a very special event taking place in Tralee. It's their annual meeting or conference which has been held on June 18th and 19th with a special event open free to members of the public on the Friday evening at the Meadowlands Hotel. And we're joined by Daniel Kidd, who is the conference organiser. We have Linda Fitzgibbon, oral historian and committee member, and Fiona Brennan, who is an ONI membership officer. And also we have Roisin Jones, who is an ONI administrator. Roisin, it must be a great thing to be involved in, is it? Must be very fulfilling.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's really rewarding. It's so interesting. And certainly, as Linda was saying there, you know, it's great having the emails coming in. And there's such different inquiries that come in. Hearing when people bring you their idea, I personally feel like it's a real privilege because you're getting an insight into what their project is going to be and what they're going to capture, so it's not lost. And it's just that it introduces you to such a wide world, you know. At the meetings that we've had, you know, that we've organised, like we were speaking about earlier, our events, and so much thanks to the Heritage Council as well, we've been able to put on different events across country. But you meet such a wide-ranging, you know, selection of people, all different ages, from all different backgrounds. We had a fantastic meeting in Athlone earlier this year, and we had some really fascinating, really poignant presentations from all different walks of life. And the people that came along to it, just anybody you could walk past in the street, and they were all had one thing in common. They wanted to capture stories and they wanted to learn how to do it. And as Daniel was saying, you know, how to capture them, what equipment to use, what resources we need, you know. So it's a learning process. You know, you can learn at any stage in life. It's so fascinating to listen to people's stories. And when you do playback and you hear someone's recording, I know from my own experience of capturing oral history testimonies, it is that privilege, because you have an insight into someone's life and those pauses and those moments. And you know, people allow you to come into their world, you know, for that moment. And it's so important, and it's so important to share it. And I've got two teenagers, and I love telling them about it and how important it is, you know, to listen to people, to hear stories, because it just opens up your world. Anyone that's listening, any of your listeners that are thinking about, oh, maybe I could do an oral, or there's somebody really interested in other, you know, get in touch with us, because we can help you. We're here to help and here to support. And don't leave it, you know, because as you say, that person is here today, but maybe gone tomorrow.
Yeah, excellent. And Daniel, finally to you, the conference, remind people when it's on and how they can go. Can they rock up on the days, or how do they go about getting more information?
Yeah, so we're in the Meadowlands Hotel in Tralee on Thursday and Friday, the 18th and 19th of June. The website is oralhistorynetworkireland.ie, or just Google Oral History Network Ireland. The event runs across the 2 days, and our early bird offer is over. But if you want to come for the 2 days, it's €80 for ONI members, or €110 for non-members, €65 concession for ONI members, or €80 concession for non-members. Membership is still open, and it runs on a calendar year basis. And that's €30 per person, or just €15 concession. Fiona is our membership officer, and she will gladly take your money. And the final event on that Friday afternoon with Kerry Writers Museum, which Fiona will chair, is free to attend. We're just asking people to register in advance using Ticketailer, and you'll find the link for that Ticketailer on the ONI website as well.
Well, it promises to be an excellent event, and I think the whole initiative is just brilliant and inspiring. So well done to all of you, and thanks for coming on this morning, Daniel Carey, Linda Fitzgibbon, and of course Roisin Jones, and last but not least, Dr. Fiona Brennan. And Fiona, I look forward to having you on again with some other wonderful initiative that you're always involved in. But for now, thanks a million, all of you, for coming on.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you.
We're going to go to break and we'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer ready meals available.
Now it is the second Saturday of the month, so that means it's time for a Kerry County Council Creative Kingdom, where we let you know what's going on in the arts world around the county. We're going to have some very special guests very shortly. To do with two wonderful festivals that are taking place soon enough. But first, as always, we'll be talking to Kate Kennelly, Arts Officer with Kerry County Council. Kate, how are you? And you had a busy few weeks with everything going on. Listowel Writers Week and, of course, Cruinniún an Óg.
We did, Joe, and good morning to your listeners. I hope they're all enjoying the summer. Joe, we've been very, very busy. We had a fantastic Cruinniún an Óg, absolutely. We had over 30 events across Kerry, and the children of Kerry came out in force and they showed us what creativity is all about. We had children doing art workshops, building robots, as you do on a Saturday. What else would you be doing, Joe? Writing your own novels, dancing, film making, animation, craft and painting. There was fabulous graffiti wonder walls down in Sheemsa, and it was just the buzz. And we had fabulous over in Killorglin as well, with Dara Kinch. The workshops there had a great attendance, and they were for older children, which is fantastic, and younger teens. And just the mix of activity was great, Joe. So I hope people feel free to get back to us, because, you know, we love to mix it up every year. And if people come back and tell us what they'd like to see happening next year, we really do listen and we do take it on board. Like this year now, we had some climate awareness events as well through creativity, which was fantastic. And we'd events, one of the ones that got left off our map was down in Sneem. So I promised Anna down in Sneem, she's going to have the biggest dot on the map next year, because she had a great turnout for her event. So just well done to everyone. And Joe, as you mentioned, Listowel Writers Week, fantastic festival. I mean, talk about pulling out all the stops for their 55th. They were just fantastic, and great programme. And congrats to Mara Logan and all the team there. And you know, there's such a strong local and community support for the festival, and they did great, great work. I was back there in the opening night, so it was fantastic to hear the speakers. They were just fantastic altogether. I've always been interested in Nicola Sturgeon, and she spoke so well. And of course, the brilliant Miriam O'Callaghan spoke proudly of her Kerry roots, which is always goes down well in the kingdom. And they were just fantastic altogether, Joe. And since then as well, since I saw you last, I had mentioned I was going up to Sligo. There was an Arts Council Arts Festivals conference on, and it was really, really good. And we had 6 attendees from Kerry, and by attendees there was a number, like there was maybe 2 or 3 per festival. So it was just a really strong Kerry showing, and it shows, I suppose, how seriously we take our arts festivals in Kerry and how important they are for festivals. And I suppose that leads us nicely along to the 2 festivals you have here with us.
Yeah, exactly. Nice segue there, Kate. So we're talking about the Onam Tralee Arts Festival, which is taking place in the first weekend of July, the 3rd, 4th and 5th of July. And I'm delighted to say we have on the line Rebecca Wall. Rebecca, you're very welcome. So tell us about this wonderful festival, the Onam Tralee Arts Festival.
Good morning, everybody. So the Onam Tralee Arts Festival is taking place, like Joe said, 3rd, 4th, 5th of July. We're a fledgling festival, and we are very much about promoting emerging and established artists within Tralee Town, or people who have a connection to Kerry and Tralee in general. And we have some amazing artists again this year who have agreed to be part of the lineup. So we have Alma Kelleher, also known as Lux Alma, who is partaking in Madden's on the actual 3rd, the Friday night. So she's kicking it off. And opposite Alma, who's obviously a phenomenal musician, composer, we have Frank Houlihan, who is High Brazzle Productions. And he's actually doing 6 plays in 6 cars in Dom O'Donnell's car park. So the audience actually climb into the back of a car. So it's 3-seater in the back, and the play actually unfolds over the space of 10 minutes. So it's quite intimate. So we have community production, and we also have these amazing established artists. And on the Saturday then, On the 4th, Independence Day, we have the amazing Ruth McKee, who is travelling down from Dublin, and she has just written a book called Wild Iris. But she also has the podcast Burning Books, and she's being interviewed by our own local Dr. Liz Quirk, an amazing writer and author, in the Tannery, which is a forgotten space on Rock Street. It's the back, actually back of Pa Daly's offices there, and it's at the back, so it's be an open sort of I suppose interview is what I would say, outdoors, so you'll get the landscape of the actual audio of the town recorded within the interview, which will be amazing. We also have Louise O'Neill, another author, coming down being interviewed by Anne O'Neill, and that will be in the Ash Hotel. And we have the amazing Ndidi O, which I feel is like the massive feather in our cap. This lady fell in love with the Kerry man, from what I have gathered, and has made her home in Kerry. And she is a stunning, stunning musician. And her she's just released a new album, and I just think it's amazing. Canadian in origin, I would describe her work as jazz, but she's going to talk to you a little bit about herself. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do a jazz and wine night in Madden's. We also have the amazing James Hayes in Shimsa, and he has his first solo exhibition, which we actually, I'll be welcoming people there on the night. And that's a free exhibition for people to come down and see. And it's all to do with the Blaskets and his experience of the Blaskets. And on the Sunday, then we have more musicians and more lineup, but we're constantly adding Joe to the lineup. So if you keep an eye on the website, adamtralee.ie, you'll see new pieces emerging all the time. But it's very much about giving Tralee back its soul and looking for spaces that we often forget about because we're so busy in our lives. Just an opportunity to stand still and appreciate right what's on our own doorstep, or often living on our own doorstep. And people like Ndidi O, who've actually made Kerry their home.
Yeah, and speaking of Ndidi O, she joins us on the line now. Ndidi, you're very welcome. So tell us about your own style, and what will people should they expect when they see you performing the next day?
Well, hello, Joe. Thank you for having me, everyone. I'm happy to be here. I think that coming to a show of mine, you will get a lot of non-sequitur, very strange stories. I speak very frankly about who I am and invite the audience to know me, and I like to get to know the audience. I do a lot of crowd work. I fancy myself a bit of a stand-up. No. I pair well with a full-bodied red if we're doing wine and jazz. I would say musically, I am a bit of a hybrid. I like to sort of play with genres, specifically genres that are usually ascribed to Black artists, of which I am one. So I combine blues, folk, a little bit of roots, but my voice and my styling are jazz, lean jazz. So it's a melange of things, and I'll have a lovely accompanist, and then I will do some songs just myself and hopefully have some audience participation. We'll see how many cups they're in, but the more wine they have, the more fun they'll have. No, just kidding.
Excellent.
I tend to be as personal as I can.
Yeah. And how long are you in Kerry?
I became an official resident as of January of this year, but I've been coming back and forth between Vancouver, British Columbia, and Kerry for like 3-4 years.
And how do you find the music scene here as opposed to back home?
Well, it's different because back home, I've been doing this for over 20 years at this point. So I'm very established in Western Canada. But here I'm new. I'm emerging. I would be kind of non-existent. And so I find it's interesting. It's very similar to how I started when I decided I was going to be a musician a bajillion years ago. I moved to New York because I thought that this was the hardest. If I'm going to make it, I got to make it in New York. It was wild. So I would go to a lot of open mics and just start singing. And I find that that's sort of a similar style here. There's a lot of sessions that just happen. So you just pop in and suddenly you're jamming with everybody. There's a lot of jams. So I do think it's a different kind of vibe. I love that there's so much support for the arts. I mean, this country really supports their artists, and it's a beautiful thing to see, which is very different. Canada isn't quite as supportive simply because it's so big. So it's really hard governmentally for councils to like really throw in. We're all so far apart. But what I love is that it's relatively inclusive, and there's just so much music. People really love music, and they're not afraid to show it and to participate. And that is, it's just beautiful. There's a lot of community, I find, in the arts scene here. And I think that that's very powerful and a very special thing unique to Ireland.
Excellent. So when are you on again? Remind people, and where?
I will be performing at Madden's on July 4th. The doors will be at 6:30. Showtime starts at 7:00.
Excellent. And Rebecca, this is what it's all about, you know, showcasing the great talent we have here in the county, established and emerging, and also to make use of certain venues as well. I like that as well, bringing them to life.
Absolutely. So there are so many different forgotten spaces within Tralee Town, and we probably as an artist community often call them slack spaces. So they might have closed down or there's a change of ownership. And if you often knock on somebody's door and say, listen, I think this would be a great place for storytelling. Not only is the artist going in telling a story, but the place actually gets to tell the audience a story as well. So there's a happy marriage of place and artist creating something like a unique experience on that, in that moment, on that night or during that day. And you'd be amazed at the people you meet where you just literally stand and probably have a conversation and you haven't met those people in ages. And we have a very new emerging culture, I would say, when it comes to art in Kerry and to music in Kerry. And I remember a time growing up 1,000 years ago when every place in Tralee was full of live music. I'd like to see that come back.
Yeah.
So if we can do that with Annam Tralee, absolutely.
Excellent. Creates a legacy. So Annam Tralee, where do people go for more information?
So annamtralee.ie, that's spelled A-N-A-M. And we also are on Eventbrite. And if you're lost in all of those, pop into Madden's and we'll sort you out.
Excellent. So Annam as in soul. So yes. And no doubt you'll be capturing the soul of the music in Kerry that weekend. So well done. Congratulations and best of luck with it and have a great weekend. And thanks for coming on, Rebecca Wall and Indidio. And from one great festival to another, the Concartan Festival takes place from the 26th to the 28th of June. And to tell us more, we have Mike Moriarty joining us. Mike, you're very welcome. Tell us, what have you planned this year?
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So, Joe, I suppose Kate is there, and she was at the very first one, which was 21 years ago. If Kate remembers that, she was Jimmy Dean and herself. They were on the stage the very first night. Yeah, and we tried to...
I remember it well. And I couldn't get over the crowd. It was packed to the rafters and the place was hopping. And when the music started, it was like the building was shaking. It was just fantastic. Yeah.
That's right, Katie. And the hardest thing, Joe, is to stop Katie from talking up on the stage. That's what the hardest thing on stage, because when you give her a microphone, she's... she's nobody better to...
I know.
After a low right of reply there.
I was very shy in those days. I don't think I said much.
So basically, I suppose it started like 21 years ago, and we did a very special night last Friday night, because Minister Patrick O'Donoghue, he came out to launch it for us, because he came to last year and he was so impressed. He said he'd try to help us out this year. So we did a launch last Friday night, which was very successful. And we had even, we had members from the 1972 Cayley Band playing there just for the bit of entertainment, which was absolutely outstanding.
Oh.
So like we're kicking it off this year now on the Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main, that to me is the highlight of the whole week, because it's a traditional concert. And we've got some very good local musicians, who they call themselves Real Colleen, which is a lovely name. And they're scattered around Ireland now, a few of them are local, but they're going to put together the opening act for us, which is, these are fantastic musicians. And then we've got Frances Kennedy, who is actually doing Compare on tonight, and she's absolutely, she was there last year now, she was our host, and she ran the whole show from the stage, and she had everyone in stitches, because as anyone that knows Frances Kennedy, she'll belt out an old song, and she's absolutely outstanding and very funny woman. And then the main act of the concert on the Friday night is Peter Street. Now, Peter Street would be fronted by Keelan McGrath, the great box player from Tipperary, and he's accompanied by three more. But Peter Street, they're an emerging band. They put themselves together last year and they're on the circuit, and that would be the highlight of the weekend for me anyway. So if anyone wants a good night of fun for a small amount of money, you'll get 3 hours of the best entertainment you'll ever have on the Friday night. And then we there'll be pub trails then, as you know, on the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, with musicians from all over Ireland. There's a guy that comes from Canada, a fellow that comes from Holland every year. You know, they put it into their diary every year. They enjoy it so much. And on the Saturday then, you have, we'll say, the Cayley, you have more pub trails. And last year we did the Kirkle Corragh, which was a lovely thing, you know, to promote the Irish language. A lot of these things are still to be finalised, because, as you know, it is in the last week, you know, you get, you know, a finalisation on things, because, you know, so can it be done can people come? And it's the same with musicians for the pub trail. It is in the last couple of weeks that the whole thing is kind of finalised. So we're hoping to do the Kirkle Corra, and we'll say we've got the Cayley. And you know, the set dancing for me is very important because it's a dying art, and like, you're not getting a lot of younger people, so it would be nice to get a few young sets in there. So, you know, just to promote set dancing, because we haven't seen it for, you know, it's a dying art, like, and it's such a lovely thing. If you remember weddings long ago, to see the polka set dancing was a big part of it, and that's gone. It would be lovely to see it come back again, so we're trying to promote that. And then on the Saturday, we've got a singing competition. The host for the singing competition is Connor. Connor and Sheila. They're just after launching a new album last Friday, and they're Connor Brosnan from Cordell and Sheila Heary, and they're two tremendous singers. So they'll be hosting the singing, and we'll have the fiddle recital on the Saturday evening, which is a beautiful few hours of the best fiddle players that get together. So it's, and busking on a Sunday as always, for all age groups, and you know, you've got pub drills. It's a packed weekend, and people actually put it into the diary every year, and it has been growing every year and getting bigger. So we're hoping that people will come on and come out and support us again this year, from the 26th to the 20th, even you can say the 29th. The Monday now is a kind of a scattering day where we've musicians come as well, and it's as I said, it's been a very successful festival, and hopefully that people will come out again and support it this year.
Excellent. And it's on in Brosna. How do you say it?
Brosna.
That's what I would say as well. Yeah, I just want to make sure. It's 100 years, or last year was 100 years since the birth of Concorton, and you've your 21st so this year, so it's always, every year seems to be a milestone by you, which is great. So best of luck with it. Where can people go finally for more information again?
Well, the Concorton Music Festival.com, or the Facebook page, Concorton Music Festival, on the Facebook page, and we'll be putting out the flyers, posters, and all that stuff around the locality as well, Joe.
Excellent. Mike Moriarty, thanks a million, and again, Gunnarian Tallat, and best of luck with it. We're going to take a break, and we'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan's.
Now, you're listening to Kerry County Council Creative Kingdom, and Arts Officer with Kerry County Council, Kate Kennelly, is still with us. So, Kate, we are into the busy period of the summer now. You have an exciting arts competition for children you want to tell us about?
Indeed, we were notified about this, Joe, from K Visual. And in case any of your listeners aren't aware, K Visual is the is a new iteration that came out of K Fest, which, as you know, was hugely successful and has inspired other festivals across the country to run similar events, because they just did such a strong offering of art in the public domain and utilising the local spaces the best they could in a really positive way. So K Visual will be happening in September, but they've announced a children's programme for 2026. And as part of it, there is an art competition. So they're inviting, now I know people don't want me to mention the S-C-H-O-O-L word this time of year, but they are inviting children at national schools throughout Kerry to take part. And it will be an exhibition of selected work, and there will be a programme of workshops designed to support children with additional needs in creating and submitting their artwork. So anyone who's interested can contact K Visual, and they will be selecting work for competition and for display. And the theme is tomorrow. So it's a chance for children to explore their imagination and express their ideas of the future in any way they choose. And they're taking artwork in two-dimensional pieces, and it's A4 size, and the deadline for submission is the 20th of June. So that'll be an interesting one, Joe. And, you know, these art competitions can be really good to build people's confidence. And, you know, I know from being at the other side of it, when you're adjudicating, you know, and there might only be one winner and maybe three highly commended, whereas you'd love to give 30 prizes, you know, because the standard is always so good. And I think that by people even making the application, you know, you need to take that as a win, because you've made the effort, you've created the work, and you've challenged yourself to do something, and that's learning for all of us. So really, really positive. Another thing, Joe, our Culture Night programme, as you know, will take place on the 18th of September. So our deadline for people to apply is the 12th of June. We extended it because we were getting loads of queries. And I think I mentioned, Joe, on your last show, as part of the EU presidency, all the local authorities were given some funding to help raise the profile of, let's say, an EU dimension in culture. So there's a number of arts festivals in Kerry that will be having an EU element. I might mention that next month because we haven't time to cover it today. But certainly under our Culture Night call out, we have some money ring fence. So if people want to do an event on Culture Night that it has some link or some relevant highlight or something that showcases EU culture or an EU artist that they're interested in. And of course, Kerry is twinned with the Czech Republic. So look, if there that might be something of interest to people. I know actually K Visual are bringing over a Czech artist at some stage to Killorglin, an artist who represented the Czech Republic at the Biennale, which is really important. So there's loads happening, Joe. And of course, there's other like Spree Curie in Killarney is kicking off. In the Annam Arts Centre, we go from the soul of Tralee to the soul of Killarney. So in the Annam Arts Centre, there'll be a lovely programme that Clive has been working on. And you have the Atlantic Wave Festival in Ballybunion. You have the Sneem Summer Festival coming up and Féile Lúnasa. So all these details are on our social media or on our arts website under our arts festival brochure and banner.
Excellent. Kay Kennelly, a pleasure as always, and I look forward to talking to you next month.
Thanks, Joe.
That's all we have time for on the programme this morning. My thanks to Abigail Bernard, who was on sound. Pat Kelly is on the way, so keep it here on Radio Kerry. I'll talk to you again next Saturday from 9 a.m. Until then, look after yourself and take care.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Because at least one day of the weekend should involve someone else doing all the cooking. Order your delicious takeaway from Quinlan's today.